Hello, you. This is the podcast of Inside Science from BBC Radio 4, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2020. I'm Adam Rutherford. It's the 200th anniversary of the discovery of Antarctica by Russians, maybe by Brits, one or the other. We'll get to the bottom of that later. Curious and curiouser, the fate of Typhoid Mary. The city of Oxford comprehensively dealt with typhoid in the 19th century. So what can we learn about epidemics from the history of science and from Alice in Wonderland? Well, we start with a rather more current infectious disease, the ongoing coronavirus epidemic that originated in China within the last few weeks. It's continued to spread. The latest reports are that more than 170 people have died from the lower lung infection caused by the virus, and 7,700 confirmed cases in mainland China in every province now, though this is likely to be a significant underestimate. Infections have been identified in people all over the world, including in the US, in Canada, Australia and a dozen other countries, and notably in Germany and Japan, where the patients didn't come directly from Wuhan City. This confirms person-to-person infections. Last week we spoke to Jonathan Ball, Professor of Virology at Nottingham University, and he came back on to update the story. I asked him to describe what we now know about the symptoms.
It's still not as clear as maybe we'd want it, and I think that's a lot to do with the rapidity of this outbreak. It's only a few weeks ago that this was first identified as a potential outbreak, and here we are talking about thousands, potentially as many as 100,000 people infected. But in general, in terms of the symptoms that people might well present, it could be anything from no symptoms at all, in other words, an asymptomatic infection, to mild flu or cold-like symptoms, to then more severe disease such as breathing difficulties that require hospitalisation, and that's usually associated with pneumonia, which might require intensive care. It's quite a broad spectrum, and the biggest problem at the moment is that we don't understand fully how many people who are infected will go on to develop each of those categories.
Yeah, and of course it's cold and flu season as well, so there's going to be confounding the doctors in terms of identifying it. Am I right in saying this primarily appears to be a lower respiratory tract infection, which means it's deep in the lungs? And so does that mean it's less susceptible to sneezes and coughs in terms of airborne droplets?
I think that's a fair assumption on the initial cases that have recently been reported, that there's been very little evidence of upper respiratory tract, so that's the nose and the throat, and also, as you say, not much sneezing associated with infection. But these deep lung infections, not only can coughing spread those, but of course just normal breathing. If the droplet size is correct and the virus is found in very, very fine droplets that you produce as you breathe, then in theory those droplets can carry quite a long distance, as much as 200 feet, maybe even more. And of course that means that people can breathe that in, and it also leads to contamination. And I think environmental contamination is the thing that we often neglect when we think about respiratory diseases. We think a lot about sneezes and coughs, but of course it's the whole contamination of things like keyboard surfaces, door handles, etc. And that's where most people contract their respiratory infections.
You mentioned asymptomatic transfer. Can you just explain how that might work?
Yeah, I think certainly I can explain how it might work, but maybe something that could be of relevance here is we've been basing a lot of our understanding on what happened with the SARS outbreak. And with the SARS outbreak, people were infectious only when they were showing symptoms, even if it was a fever. And you could use, for example, temperature monitoring as a good indicator for somebody who might be potentially spreading virus, and therefore isolate them, and you can go about the whole process of infection control. But the problem with these asymptomatic individuals is if, and it is still a big if they can transmit the virus, then it means it's very difficult to identify them and to bring the infection chains of transmission under control. So I think that's why we're very worried about this whole process of asymptomatic infection, but also at the moment we don't really understand enough about it. We have a feeling that they might potentially transmit virus because some of the studies, particularly those of family cluster, and one of the children in that family cluster was clearly infected. There was evidence of active replication of the virus, but that child felt very well. There was no outward signs of infection, and that's the worry.
Yes, and indeed, a family from Wuhan who had all contracted it had not been in contact with the market itself, which is where we think the reservoir for the coronavirus emerged. At least that's the working theory.
Yeah, this is the other significant thing that's played out over the last week. And I think there's clear evidence that there was virus circulating in that market. A recent report showed that a team of scientists collected environmental samples, and they collected those samples from various parts of the market. And the market that was known to have been the place where they were selling lots of live animals, mammals in particular, of the 35 samples that they collected there, 31, it's an incredible number, 31 out of 35 had presence of the coronavirus. So clearly there's a huge amount of virus kicking about in that particular part of the market. But then when you look at the case studies, you can see that lots of the people who were infected with the virus had no direct link to the fish market. So clearly something else was spreading the virus. Now, some of my colleagues would suggest that maybe it is people who have been to the market and then an indirect route that virus has come back. But I think one of the things that surprised me when I read those reports is the statement that some of those people who were infected had visited other markets. And therefore, there is the potential for an animal reservoir in more than one market to have been spreading the virus. But again, it's supposition, it's hypothesis, and until we get hard facts, we can't really say.
Now, when we spoke to you last week, you said that of paramount importance was establishing that there was an animal reservoir and trying to understand that so we could see how that spillover has actually occurred. And you just alluded to that it might be in multiple locations, not just this one fish market in Wuhan City. Now that we know that there's human-to-human transfer, does that still matter, the idea that there's an animal reservoir?
The importance decreases because the clear driver of the infection at the moment is human-to-human transmission, and that brings its own problems. But in terms of understanding that spillover event, the initial transfer of virus from animal to human, it does impact on the estimates that we have for the number of infections that the virus can seed, because there are particular values that epidemiologists use. These are values that predict how many people an infected person will go on to infect. And those are based on, very often, the initial stages of the infection. So understanding how many separate animal-to-human transmissions this whole outbreak resulted from is important, because if it was one and we've seen a lot of transmission, then it means that the virus is more easily transmitted from human to human. If there are multiple animal to human transmissions at the outset, then that brings that number down. So it's important in terms of understanding how the outbreak might spread. But of course, as you rightly point out, Adam, we've now got so many human-to-human transmissions that we'll start to get a better feel for how the virus is behaving by studying those transmissions. But actually getting a clear handle on the extent of the outbreak is now proving to be the difficulty.
Yes, and of course, quarantine and lockdown and restrictions on travel and movement, this is all beginning to happen within China, and government advice, British Airways are no longer flying directly to China whilst this is going on. Is this the correct procedure when we now know that person-to-person transmission is definitely happening?
I think it's a wise response, and obviously it comes with logistical challenges. If the number that are returning, you can easily handle them in isolation, you can easily quarantine them, then it's a sensible thing to do. It's 14 days and it will limit the immediate threat from importation of the coronavirus. But of course, there are lots of worries about the amount of travel that's gone on before today or before this week. It would have been significant. And the risk of those people passing on that infection, it all depends, again, on pretty much an unknown amount. And that's the incubation period for this virus.
Now, obviously, we're comparing it to SARS, which has a lot of significant parallels, but they are different. And China is handling it very differently from the way that they handled SARS. One report suggests that the new virus is more infectious but less dangerous than SARS. Are these comparisons useful? Are they helping us to process this?
So I think having a benchmark like SARS is helpful because it does give us an insight into how the virus might be behaving. But it can be misleading if there are important factors that differ between the two viruses. So, for example, the whole concept of this asymptomatic transmission of the virus, if this is real And if it does occur to reasonably significant levels, then that totally changes the game in terms of the comparison of this current novel coronavirus with SARS. But in terms of helping those infected, particularly the more seriously infected, it does give an insight into the likely clinical progress of the infection. But then when we come back to the relative numbers of people who might have asymptomatic versus mild versus serious disease, it's still too early to say how that will break down. And in truth, I think it wasn't that easy to work out in the SARS outbreak, because a lot of the focus was on the people who were most seriously ill, because very often they were the ones who gave rise to most onward transmissions of the virus. So it's still early days, but there are lots of factors that are thrown into the mix that mean we're maybe slightly more worried at the moment than maybe we were at the same stage of the SARS outbreak.
Now, as you say, it's limited information, where this is a story unfolding every day. The numbers are changing by the hour. From a scientist's point of view, from a virologist's point of view, caution versus fear, how concerned are you?
I think more concerned certainly than this time last week, purely because of the number of cases that we see reported. That seems to almost double by the day or every couple of days. And I think also the fact that China is so well connected to other parts of the world. Travel is so easy today. And China is also well connected to lots of developing countries, where there's significant investment in things like industrial infrastructure, transport infrastructure, but unfortunately healthcare infrastructure and surveillance hasn't really kept pace with that. And so the worst case scenario is if this virus ends up getting seeded into areas of the world that don't have the capacity to carry out appropriate surveillance and then infection control, particularly if the export of viruses quite significant, then I think that raises the bar for us. I think the longer term picture might be slightly more worrying. Now, of course, I don't say the word worrying meaning that there will be an apocalyptic plague developing in the next year. It may well be that it is just another of the circulating respiratory infections that most of us, it's inconvenient and pretty nasty. And for a few, it might be more serious. But you know, it's too early to say, but that is one scenario. The alternative is that the infection control that's being tried in China and all over the world will get on top of it and the outbreak will be brought under control. But of course, each day that goes by, each increase in infected cases, that becomes more and more difficult.
The idea that this started in an animal reservoir in the fish market and then it transferred to humans, when you talk about how perhaps in developing countries that people carrying the infection may, because of the infrastructure, it may spread more easily. Is there a risk that it might re-enter an animal reservoir and therefore form a permanent pool from which it can re-emerge repeatedly?
That's a fantastic question. And very often we think about viruses, when they spill over into humans, it's unlikely that they will be perfectly tuned to infect and transmit in humans. And so what these human-to-human transmission chains might do is give the ability of the virus to evolve, to gain adaptive mutations, which mean that it's more fit for replication and transmission in humans. And of course, very often as it does that, it becomes less fit for its original reservoir. So in other words, for it to then get back into its original reservoir when it's transported to another part of the world, it's got to go through the reverse set of processes. It has to get into the animal and then probably adapt again to be as fit as it was. But of course, if it goes one way, it can certainly go the other way. But I wouldn't want people to think that it can go straight in with no problems. There is always a species barrier.
Jonathan Ball from the University of Nottingham. As we were just saying, we can learn from previous epidemics such as SARS, but also from a much deeper history. After all, infectious diseases are an ever-presence in human history. Alice in Typhoid Land is a new project in Oxford recording how that city dealt with typhoid. It's called that after one of its 19th century residents, Alice Liddell. She was the girl after whom Alice in Wonderland was named. Her father, Henry Liddell, was the Dean of Christchurch College, and together with his friend Henry Ackland, they were instrumental in closing off Oxford's open sewers and combating some of the causes of the disease. BBC Inside Science's Louisa Field went to meet curators Drs. Samantha van der Slot and Claes Kirscheller down a rabbit hole at the University of Oxford.
We've entered the Western Library, this beautiful big old hall with rows of books on the balcony and your exhibition as a centrepiece. Alice in Typhoid Land, a reference to Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, I presume?
We designed a world around typhoid in Victorian Oxford. And the reason we chose Alice Liddell, aka Alice in Wonderland, as our main theme is that while we were doing research on the history of typhoid, we found the name of Alice in the family cropping up again and again. So we've designed a whole series of animations, but also digital maps of Oxford around Alice Liddell and the family. And the Alice you see in front of us is actually based on the original photos of the young Alice that Charles Dodgson, aka Lewis Carroll, took of her as a photographer in the 1860s.
What we wanted to do through this exhibition, instead of going down the rabbit hole, is actually go down the sewer hole.
Sounds a bit smelly. Yeah, down the sewer hole.
And smelly would have been dangerous at that time, okay, because you had the theory of miasma where smelly air was actually causing ill health.
And Alice's father has a part to play in this story.
Yes, so Alice's dad, Henry Liddell, was Dean of Christ Church College, and he was one of the big sanitary reformers in Oxford with his close friend Henry Ackland, who was a prominent doctor at the time.
So did typhoid spark better sanitation here in Oxford and across the UK?
So typhoid becomes the kind of poster boy disease that the Victorians can concentrate on as a sign of their progress that they're making in terms of protecting their inhabitants.
I don't think I've ever met someone so excited about sewage systems as you two.
We didn't think we were either, but we've managed to get very excited about it through the course of this exhibition.
I mean, you just see the work it does.
As Victorian Oxford closed its open sewers, typhoid cases started to decrease. And we know this because scientists at the time conveniently drew detailed maps and graphs that showed the correlation between better drains and decline in disease.
If you look at the map that Henry Ackland here has painted for you or drawn, it's extremely detailed. And you see the areas shaded in dark green, those are areas of high mortality. So he is correlating typhoid to low-lying, poor drainage, and also poor area.
Typhoid's real cause, the bacteria Salmonella typhi, would only slowly come to light throughout the 19th century, when a German scientist called Robert Koch makes a remarkable and somewhat chilling discovery. Not only is typhoid a killer, but you could, unknowingly, be a carrier of the disease. You could have it and spread it without getting ill yourself. This was the unfortunate fate that struck Mary Mallon, a respected cook in New York City households.
What seems to happen in every family that Mary cooks for is that people start becoming ill. And the reason for that is that Mary Mallon, aka Typhoid Mary, is the most famous so-called healthy carrier that we know of.
Mary's America is the early 20th century, a time of progress. Cities get fitted with electricity, telephones, movie theatres, steel, railroads, machines. Science is going full steam ahead. But we are still far away from scientists truly unravelling the secret lives of bacteria, yet alone an uneducated public. Even further away is the discovery of antibiotics. So typhoid sufferers and carriers like Mary would have to wait decades for a cure. Mary's fate is sealed when a detective, George Soper, is hired by a concerned and disease-struck household. He knows about Robert Koch's work and quickly discovers a link between the spread of typhoid. So he knocks on Mary's door and demands a sample of her fluids. There are various accounts of what happens next. Soper himself wrote up much of the history on the case, so we can assume some amount of bias, if not questionable reliability. But one thing is certain: Mary takes great offence and refuses. In Soper's account of her, he later describes how she seized a carving fork and chased her accuser out onto the street. It's hard to blame her.
Bacteriology at this point in time is a new discipline. The knowledge of bacteria is completely new. Mary does not believe it.
Someone's telling her that these little weird tiny animals are living inside her body and she's making people ill. That would be a hard one to swallow, especially if they're taking your profession away.
Absolutely, and also because it's casting a bad light on your hygiene habits as a cook and as a proud cook. So there is this inherent tension in the story of Mary Mallon, where on the one hand said, yes, she is a healthy carrier, she is spreading typhoid, people that she was cooking for die. On the other hand, she is an Irish immigrant in the US in the early 1900s facing a growing anti-immigration climate.
This is not the first time, or the last, that disease will be used to control and stigmatise certain groups. The Nazis would later accuse Eastern Jews of carrying and spreading the disease. Marion Mallon does eventually get tested. The authorities are at loss about what to do with her. But she is eventually, against her will, quarantined on North Brother Island outside New York City. 3 years later, she's released on the conditions that she will not work as a cook again. But Mary isn't prepared to give up cooking. She starts to work under a new name, Mary Brown. Once again, typhoid strikes her employers.
She's again tracked down, and this time because she is recalcitrant, at least those are the words of the male prosecutors who then speak against her.
Interesting word you put in there, male.
Absolutely. It is a reason that her case is sensationalized. She is not the only typhoid carrier around during this period. Other typhoid carriers are also being found, but Mary is sensationalized by the press. Again, she's female, she's Irish, she's supposedly ignorant, and there are these graphics of the time of a really spreading typhoid in an almost nefarious way to her employers.
In the exhibition here, you've actually got some pictures of newspaper clippings.
Yes.
So there's a picture of Mary with a frying pan frying skulls, and that was the way that she was caricatured as this person who was out there to poison people in a way.
It's really interesting how that image works, because you now see it as frying skulls. It could also be that she is spreading them almost miasma-like to the frying pan, which
would be
the way readers in previous years might have even seen that once.
In 1939, Mary Mallon dies in quarantine. As far as we know from her letters, she never accepts what the authorities accuse her of, being a healthy carrier of typhoid. And in the UK, we have our own examples of typhoid Marys.
The UK has a long history of dealing with typhoid carriers. Most typhoid carriers were allowed to just continue living their ordinary lives, provided they safely disposed of the sewage and they followed hygiene precautions. But there was a small subsection of women in the UK who were not deemed mentally firm enough to take care of not spreading typhoid to other people. So there is a sad story in the UK of some of these women ending up in mental asylums with no way to get out again. We have so far not heard of men suffering a similar fate.
Yeah, it does raise some questions that it was only women that were being detained.
Stories like Mary's and the women who were locked away in sanitariums in the UK do feel to have a certain reminiscence of the past that perhaps shape how we think of typhoid, a disease that is long solved by antibiotics and vaccines. But a new threat looms. Antibiotic-resistant typhoid, so-called XDR. Many areas around the world suffer from poor sanitation and contaminated drinking water. And here, typhoid has found its perfect breeding ground.
There are still parts of the world that don't have sanitation systems and clean water, and this is where typhoid is still in existence. And we also have the rise of antibiotic-resistant typhoid, so strains that are resistant to most of the commonly used antibiotics.
The arms race between the typhoid bacteria and the antibiotics has had all too perfect conditions to play out.
Typhoid was never a disease of the past. It was always a disease that was with us. It's just that in wealthy countries we got rid of it and then we tended to forget about it and the infrastructures needed to defeat it. Now, XDR is a wake-up call for the global community that shows that we ignore diseases in poorer countries at our own peril. Thus, we both have a moral obligation and also a self-interest obligation to step in and take more decisive action.
Travellers are spreading the disease too. Cases have been reported in the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, Iraq, Guatemala, Germany, and throughout the African continent. Though much more rare, you can also be a healthy carrier of antibiotic-resistant typhoid, not unlike typhoid Mary, and unknowingly cause an outbreak of a disease that may no longer respond well to the antibiotics armoury we have relied on for so many years. Across the road from the Western Library in Oxford is the second half of Clay's and Samantha's exhibition. They guide me down an ancient stone staircase and into the basement of the History of Science Museum.
Okay, so this is where science is now being displayed, but it actually used to happen.
The room has a vaulted ceiling because for some time it was a chemistry lab and later used for autopsies. A blackboard with Einstein's writing from a class he once taught hangs on the far wall.
And we're standing in front of our displays on the history of vaccination and typhoid control, seen from not the perspective of sanitation, but from the bacterium itself.
In response to the outbreaks around the world, a new vaccine has been fast-tracked here in Oxford. Before it, there was no vaccine for children under the age of 2, a very vulnerable group. The new vaccine also offers longer immunity and has recently been rolled out in India, Nepal, Cambodia and Nigeria. In fact, 10 million children were vaccinated in the span of a month in the Sindh province in Pakistan. This new chapter in typhoid prevention is documented here.
The new typhoid conjugate vaccine was tested in Oxford Vaccine Group, and 100 participants actually drank live typhoid bacteria to test whether the vaccine worked very well. So if we go over to one of our cases here, you can see some of the objects that are connected with that trial. So it's called a human challenge study.
Vaccines can take quite a long time to develop, but this one, there was sort of an urgency and it was actually rolled out pretty fast from start to finish.
Yeah, so this vaccine got approval from the WHO, got pre-approval quite quickly because of the outbreaks that were going on and because the early signs from the human challenge study were quite positive. So this is a way of actually quickening the process of developing a vaccine because you need to test for safety and efficacy, so the effectiveness of the vaccine. And doing this in a smaller group of people rather than whole populations to begin with is a way of speeding up that process.
So the new vaccine, is it going to protect against that antibiotic-resistant type of typhoid as well?
Yeah, so it's shown to be very effective. So this is our best hope at the moment of as a preventative method along with sanitation, water and hygiene methods.
Samantha van der Slot talking to Louisa Field. Now, just a quick mention of a project by my colleague Claudia Hammond from All in the Mind. She's captaining the Radio 4 Touch Test, a global online questionnaire about touch. Lots of the research on interpersonal touch was conducted in the 1970s and 80s, and we want to know whether things have changed. So, with your help, we can fill in some gaps in the research. Wherever you live in the world, we'd love to know what you think about touch. You can take part at the website touchtest.org. Finally today, exactly 200 years ago as we record this, that's the 30th of January 1820, at 3:30 local time, the continent of Antarctica was spotted for the first time by a British expedition captained by Edward Bransfield on the merchant ship the Williams. But they weren't the very first, because 3 days earlier, on the 27th of January, a Russian expedition led by Fabian Gottlieb von Bellingshausen and Mikhail Lazarev spotted what is now known as the Fimbul Ice Shelf. It was a tight-run thing and something that Captain Cook had failed to do in the preceding few years. The UK Antarctic Heritage Trust is spearheading celebrations. Camilla Nicol is their CEO, and I asked her, what was the motivation for heading so far south?
There was certainly a lot of interest in the Southern Oceans at that time as different nations were seeking new sealing grounds. So the Southern Oceans were starting to open up. Captain Cook, famously 50 years previously, had tried to circumnavigate Antarctica and failed to spot it. But the year previous, William Smith, a British sailor, did spy the South Shetland Islands and recognised there were seals there and landmasses and thought, well, hang on, there must be more here. So he was actually instructed to go again under a new captain, Edward Bransfield, to go and see if they could find Antarctica. Bellingshausen and the Russian expedition were actually circumnavigating Antarctica, but they didn't lay claim to spotting it, actually, even though they spied the Fimbul ice shelf.
Well, let's just talk about Cook for a second, because, of course, you know, he was the great explorer of the age, at least as far as Brits are concerned. And how come he got so close but didn't actually see Antarctica?
It was a combination of things, really. He was in a ship that nothing like the ice-strengthened vessels we see today, so he couldn't penetrate ice in the way that you can now. Also, the time of year he was there. He was there when there was still a lot of sea ice. And he was, you know, he was a sensible navigator and a sensible captain. He encountered an awful lot of ice, sea ice, large ice islands, as you call them, icebergs as we know them today, and knew he couldn't penetrate further south. So he did cross the Antarctic Circle 3 times, but when you look at the map, you see, oh, he should have just crossed it in a different part and you would have spotted something. Sadly, just a little bit off and just didn't quite get to the peninsula and other parts of Antarctica. So very unlucky, actually.
And let's just do a bit of deep history here, because I didn't know this anniversary was coming up. I just assumed people knew that Antarctica had been there well, for a while longer. But what did we know before this discovery 200 years ago about the existence of land and ice at the bottom of the world?
Well, until the 18th century, it was just a presumption that Antarctica was there. And it actually goes back to the ancient Greeks. They sort of speculated and reasoned that there must be a landmass at the base of the Earth to counter the weight of the Arctic. And that's why it's called the Antarctic, as it in opposition to the Arctic. So the ancient Greeks had supposed there must have been. And, you know, Cook set off in 1770s to go and find it, thinking, well, there must be something here. There was a lot of activity in previous centuries, sort of 15th, 16th centuries, as the Southern Ocean and the South America were being explored. And people getting further and further south and spotting things like icebergs and what have you, and thinking, well, these are coming from somewhere.
And there was no indication that any of the indigenous people of the South Pacific or around the Antarctic Circle had ever got close before. It was Europeans who got there first.
Well, it was Europeans that first wrote it down, I think, to be fair. There certainly is speculation that some Chileans may have managed to reach the Antarctic several years previously, and there are certainly folk tales that suggest that, but they're not a culture that wrote things down. History, as we see so often, is down to who wrote things down.
Now, of course, this is the era of European expansion and, well, to a certain extent, plunder. What is the motivation for both Russian and British ships trying to find Antarctica at this time?
There was certainly a lot of interest in sealing. So it was fishing for seal pelts. And this was a big business. And once Antarctica had been discovered and news got out, lots of ships went down. And actually, for the next 100 years, you saw devastation of the mammal life, really, in Antarctica as ships, one after the other, went down and took as many seals as they could, and then later whaling. And at peak times, you were seeing 150,000 to 200,000 seals being slaughtered each season. And as you can imagine, that decimated the populations, and they're only just recovering, really.
Right, a huge untapped resource to exploit. How did they divvy up the lands? If the Russians saw it 3 days ago and the Brits got it today, what was the agreement in place?
There was none at that time. The kind of geopolitics of it really sort of took off towards the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And it was really when the whaling was at its peak and nations were thinking, or particularly UK, were thinking, well, we need to tax this. This is a big industry. We can slice some taxation from this. And we need structure and a governance in order to do that. So in 1908, the UK asserted their sovereign claim to the British Antarctic Territory, which is a big slice of cheese, if you like, that covers the Antarctic Peninsula, the Weddell Sea, right down to just below Thwaites Glacier.
And why did they only take a slice then? What was the impetus for not saying, well, we're going to have the whole of this?
Well, I think to start with, claiming the whole thing was certainly appealing to them, and they did have a go at it, but the other nations were not having that. They just picked the most profitable section. The Antarctic Peninsula was where all the whaling was going on. So as soon as they could assert sovereignty, they can apply some laws and some tax laws. Every catch in British waters and British land could be taxed.
And I'm looking at the map now in front of me, and the biggest chunk goes to Australia and the UK and New Zealand, which of course are all at this time part of the Commonwealth. Well, they still are, but there's also Chile and Norway and Argentina, and well, actually Norway has two different slices. How did they work that out?
Oh, well, that was one big slice to start with until the French popped up and said, well, hang on a minute, we discovered this part down here. Can we have a slice, please? What's interesting is the Commonwealth countries, for example, Australia and New Zealand, those sections were actually apportioned by the UK at that time. So they said, well, we'll have this section, but it'd be jolly good if you could also have those and control the waters around those sections of Antarctica. The other nations, Norway, big whaling nation, obviously. And then it wasn't until the Second World War that Chile and Argentina were starting to get a bit cheesed off with Britain asserting this claim in what they considered to be theirs, and they asserted their own claims too, which overlapped with the UK's. And that's unusual because the rest of the Antarctica has been carved up rather neatly like a cheesecake, whereas the Antarctic Peninsula has these three overlapping claims, and that led to considerable tensions during the Second World War.
And of course, a lot of our biggest interest in the Antarctic comes from the sort of heroic age of exploration. People will have heard us on this programme talk about Shackleton's various expeditions up to 1917, I think it is. How does it go from being a sort of commercial venture and a territorial claim into moving much towards what it is now, which is primarily a sort of scientific land?
Yeah, so you found that these claims were being rather more heavily asserted. So people were there year round, flags were being flown year round also, stamps were being issued, post office opening, that sort of thing. So much of that was going on. The Cold War was also playing a role in this. So the USA and the Soviet Union, the tensions there were sort of playing out on the Antarctic continent also. Now, in 1957, there was an effort called the International Geophysical Year, which was a big scientific international collaboration where nations across the world came together under the auspices of science to carry out the biggest scientific study ever seen. It was primarily focused on Antarctica, but not exclusively, but a lot of science in Antarctica. It was when a lot of the science stations you recognise the names of today, South Pole Station, Vostok, Palmer, were established. And this really paved the way for the Antarctic Treaty in 1959.
Now, on Inside Science, I suppose we talk about Antarctica probably more than almost any other nation because it is so scientifically interesting and because of climate change and global warming and such research going on there to understand the changing climate. So you're the CEO of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. What does it do?
We're here to tell this story. We're here to tell the story of the sort of 250 years of Antarctic exploration and study and science. But we look after the historic huts in Antarctica. These are very early scientific stations from the 1940s up to 1992. We have six that tell the story of British scientific endeavour in Antarctica. It's the birthplace of the British Antarctic Survey at Port Lockroy. And we look after these, conserve these wooden sheds in the most extraordinary, difficult climate on Earth. But we do this so that they can continue to tell their story.
And how are you marking the celebration, this 200-year anniversary?
Well, it's a big deal for us. It's an opportunity to reflect on those 200 years of discovery, exploitation, exploration, now science. So we've devised a year-long programme of events across the UK, and we've engaged artists and scientists, historians, young people, and composers and filmmakers to come together to think about and explore themes around Antarctica, to think about how we learn from the last 200 years, how we inspire the next generation to take responsibility for this precious place, and how our actions here impact this extraordinary place on our planet.
Camilla Nicol from the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Their website is ukaht.org. Do go and have a look. This is Inside Science, produced in the BBC Radio Science Unit by Fiona Roberts, and I'm Adam Rutherford. I'm off for a couple of weeks, but if you miss me, Curious Cases is back next week, and I'm doing Book of the Week. You cannot escape me.